Hello, and welcome to another episode of Blood on the Rocks. I'm your host, Akshay Taylor, and today I'm joined by special guest, Mark Vincent. Do you want to introduce yourself a little bit?
So, I'm a lecturer from the University of East Anglia in Norwich, and I do stuff on Russian crime, so I'm going to be talking about a serial killer today. My stuff's more broadly on things like criminal tattoos and all kinds of like horrible stuff that goes on in Russia.
Mm-hmm. I'm excited.
Yeah, me too.
So, yeah, do you want to just quickly say a little bit about what you're going to talk about today? Just like a quick overview.
Yeah, cool. So I'm just going to be going over the case of a serial killer from in the early 1920s. So without giving too much away, I mean, the main kind of points from it, I guess, there's this dude and he's in his early 50s. No one can really work it out because they don't know his date of birth. But early 50s, between 1921 and 1923, kills around about 33 people, although figures don't quite match up there as well. He does follow the same MO in all the murders, which is kind of like really interesting. He gets the death penalty, which isn't even a thing at that time. They have to kind of bring it back for this case. And also that his name isn't Komarov, which is how this account has been discussed in the past. It's always the case of Vasily Komarov. His name is actually Petrov, and there's a story behind why it gets changed, which I found really kind of fascinating as well.
Awesome. So, and mine is going to be, I'm going to be going back to the mid-70s, the Korean Demilitarized Zone, which I think a lot of people know about. It's what splits North and South Korea. And it was a time where I don't want to give away too much, so let's just say the US is good at a lot of things, and one of those things is a show of force. And this is a time when the US and North Korea essentially nearly went to war in the mid-70s over a tree.
I think people have gone to war for less.
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, it's normally what's underneath the ground, right?
Yeah, so I don't want to give too much away before I go into it, before my section, I'll leave it there. Oh yeah, and today I'm drinking a beer from Siren Craft Brew called Broken Dream, and it's a 6.5% breakfast stout.
Nice. I'm drinking this thing from Hitachino Nest Beer. This is like from leftover from one of the sets that people give you right for Christmas. it's called white ale. I have absolutely no idea like what it is. It's 5.5, so it sounds like it's going to be fun.
Yep. And I've got a Carlsberg on reserve just in case. I'm not working tomorrow, so maybe.
Well, no.
So, Mark, I normally give my guests a choice. Do you want to go first or should I?
I think maybe I'll take the guest's like prerogative of going first.
Okay, sure.
I kind of feel pumped up for it now.
Excellent.
So let's do that. That's cool with you.
Yeah, that works for me. So in that case, we'll cut to music and then come right back. And we are back. So, Mark, I believe you're going to tell us about a Russian serial killer. Do you want to take it away?
Yeah, totally. So I'm going to use the chance again to, just have a look, kind of have a little bit of fun with this and continue to rip off the title of the Netflix show, Making a Murderer. So I've been lecturing a lot around the UK and going off to the States under the title Making a Soviet Murderer, kind of hoping that Netflix might pick up on it and not get me into too much trouble. But also I do kind of like feel that Making a Soviet Murderer, like as the case kind of unfolds in the way that I'm going to tell it, is reasonably appropriate, even though some of it is just me doing it for attention seeking. the case is reasonably well known in Russia, so it's not hard to get hold of stuff in Russian on it. Although I haven't got any stuff from the courts yet, but newspaper reports and so on. But this kind of actually started out by me finding stuff in New York Times archives. So I guess that's as good a place as any to start. So there's an article in the New York Times, which very kind of like vividly talks about a pair of death sentences which are passed upon Vasily Komarov and his wife Sofia. So just to, I mean, to kind of, you know, draw you a picture of them, they're pretty old. They're wearing clothes in the only image that I can find anywhere of them that could only be described as very, very Russian. So this kind of sweet, picturesque Russian couple. I think Sofia is a little younger, but Komarov is in his early 50s. Right, so they get sentenced to the death penalty for killing a combined total of 33 people. Right, and this all kind of takes place between February 1921 and May 1923.
Wow, that's a really short time.
Yeah. But also, like, a kind of really pivotal time. Like, the revolution happens in 1917, and they're straight into a civil war. So the civil war is still going on, albeit a little bit away from Moscow at this point. But also there's a famine as well, because the Soviet regime are just kind of struggling to really do anything. There's not a real, like, sense of control at all. So people in large urban areas like Moscow are really, really poor at the time. And this certainly kind of feeds into some of Komarov's actions, I think, later on, at least. Some of the reasons that he gives for the crimes, anyway. So, yes, it's a really short space of time, February 1921 to May 1923. Right, so Komarov has the same MO. Right, the victims are all male. They all come from a semi-rural background. Basically, it seems like most of them are peasants who've gravitated to the city for work. They all have this kind of interest in horse trading, as I'm going to talk about later. That's where Komarov picks all of his victims up from. But also in terms of the act of murdering them itself, they're all killed the same way, they're all cut up the same way, and they're all bound and tied in the same way in these small sacks, almost like the kind of, like, you know, the kind of cheap sports holders that you can pick up from I don't want to say, like, DW Sports or wherever. And then their bodies are strewn around, like, quite a small area, which is not that far from where Komarov lives. So this article talks about the proceedings of the court itself, talking about how many people are there watching it. So people are packed into this courtroom, then they're all ushered outside. They wait under armed guard until 2 in the morning when this verdict gets read out. So the journalist talks about how there hadn't been such an interest in Moscow for a non-political event up until this point, and talks about how the trial was upgraded from the regular court chamber to this kind of ad hoc court set up in the Polytechnic Museum because of the interest in it. So, like, this New York Times article just describes the kind of excitement and the kind of the fact that this is a huge kind of sensation in Moscow at the time, which is quite something, considering, like, the events there in the, you know, in the past few years, with the government being overthrown in St. Petersburg and the civil war breaking out and so on. So, yeah, so this newspaper article really captured that. So that got my kind of attention fairly quickly. Also, the names that they give to Vasily as well. So I haven't probably used these names as much as I would like to, because I've mainly done this to loads of stuffy academics who probably wouldn't appreciate it. But, like, he's known as the Wolf of Moscow, the Human Wolf, and this is kind of popularized into the Wolf of Shabalovka Street. So, like, originally, before deciding to rip off Netflix, I wanted to do something with Wolf of Wall Street, Wolf of Shabalovka Street, you know. So they use this really kind of, like, bestial, you know, kind of wolf description for him. And they talk about his facial features, his sadism, and also they kind of continue to go back to the fact that he'd already tried to take his own life on a number of occasions as well. So that's the kind of way into the case for me, is through the end of it and, you know, what happens during the trial. So then I started kind of working backwards, trying to kind of almost set up my office at home to be like True Detective or something, where I had a map of Moscow set up and little pins, you know. I think I just had this idea that I could try and play out some of my, like, kind of childhood desires to be a detective. So there's this prolonged investigation, which actually, when you start to have a look at it, you know, all right, we're looking at it, like, in hindsight, but stuff falls together pretty easily. I mean, this case is not one that, I mean, this is the only reason why that ripping off the Netflix show might not work, because this is cut and dry, this case. All these murders of these guys, he kind of confesses to them anyway. And as the detectives see everything fall into place, like, fairly logically, I suppose, he's a carriage driver in the city. And what they start to realise is a large number of victims are found around the vicinity of a horse market, which runs twice a week. Given that the body's always found in the days immediately after trading, and that the sacks that I described earlier contained traces of hay or oats, they begin to realise that it must be someone from the horse market, and then they interview a few people there, and they begin to hear Komarov's name coming up more and more, and he's pointed out as being someone who's there regularly, but he never seems to do any real kind of business there. So again, all right, you know, they've probably got other stuff going on in Moscow at the same time, but I mean, it becomes fairly obvious who this dude is. So they enter his property. I mean, they like during this time with this, you know, the Soviet state kind of like trying to fit everything together. They do it under the pretext of looking for an illegal brew house, like a moonshine factory, which is of course, like, you know, something that they probably shouldn't have done, but ultimately, you know, this thing happens anyway. So they get into his outside stable and they find a corpse that's buried under a stack of hay there. No, this thing is then done. Everything has come together. Komarov actually legs it. Like, he actually runs away for an open window, and they catch up with him a few days later. And at that point, he confesses to a total of 33 murders. Wow. 22 had been found already, and 5 more were found with the aid of his testimony. There is a slight discrepancy there, because there's another 5 that are unaccounted for. And the investigations team just decide that they'd been sunk to the bottom of the main river that, you know, that kind of flows through that part of the city. And yeah, Komarov is happy to kind of admit to those as well. So there are a few holes there, but nevertheless, like, you know, he's tried, and he's given the death penalty for 33 murders.
That's a lot. 3 years, was it? So, was it 3 years?
Well, not even that. So it's February 1921 to May 1923. So it's a lot in the short space of time. But then, you know, I know a reasonable amount about serial killers. I mainly just watch documentaries on them, and I'm kind of fascinated by them. But yeah, there is a huge amount of opportunism to this particular case. And I think as he starts doing it, and also the reason that he gives for it when he's interviewed by a number of different people, is that he just needs the money. Like, this is out of any of the cases of Russian serial killers that I've looked at. Like, this is the most kind of straightforward, I think. This is the most practical, I guess.
It's also like right after World War One as well. So I guess they're dealing with a lot of shit right now.
And also there's a lot of stuff that going on around this area of the city. I mean, this part of the city is known for having this huge radio tower, which is not in use anymore, kind of fairly obviously. But during this time, this radio tower is being built. So I'd imagine having that there is a big distraction, alongside, you know, the kind of poverty attached to, you know, being still involved in the Civil War, and the famine as well, that is obviously a part of that as well. So there is a lot going on, and he has the opportunity to do this. And I think once he doesn't get arrested at an early stage, he just continues to do it because his main motivation, and I haven't found anything that would suggest otherwise, it's just for the money. There have been people that I've found, and I've been looking at kind of Russian newspapers or Russian sources attached to this case, have suggested that, like, he doesn't really get that much money. So I had a go at working it out. Like, he gets around 50p from each victim, and that adds up to like just under 20 quid overall. So I then worked out how much it was today, and it's just under £300. I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot, but like, considering that he is completely destitute in Moscow during the Civil War and there's a famine going on, I mean, I think it probably would be a reasonable amount about that time.
Yeah, because it'll buy food, at least.
Yeah. There are a few accounts which suggest a variety of kind of different reasons, or try to portray the case in a slightly different way, because they seem to fit into, like, more into the kind of ideology of the new Soviet regime, which is how I've kind of come up with making a Soviet murderer part of this. And the reason that I've been able to do that is because I've managed to find it wasn't particularly difficult, it was a copy in London, an edited volume by a criminological bureau from the 1920s, and there's like part of that volume is dedicated to this case. So along with the New York Times stuff, I kind of used the views of the criminologist to kind of see, like, you know, the comparison between. So the criminological bureau, they focus heavily on a number of things from Komarov's biography, his upbringing. So the criminologist's account of the Komarov case talks about Komarov's relationship with alcohol and suggests that, that this comes from his parents, or most prominently his dad. So his dad actually collapses and drowns in a ditch due to being hammered, essentially. And also, Komarov had grown up in a rural household where there'd been a lot of domestic violence. Again, I don't really have any way of providing any kind of real evidence for that, but it certainly wouldn't be out of place, during this time in the Russian Empire. So they focus on Komarov's father and then also the drinking habits of his mum as well. They kind of touch on his mum and her relationship with booze a little bit, and his five or six brothers. One of his brothers ends up gets banged up, and he gets sent to this prison, essentially on an island, very, very far away from anything, because he drunkenly assaults a government official. The criminologists kind of really focus on his relationship with alcohol, probably that it's not massively different from a lot of people at that time, but this is a particular thing that the Criminological Bureau are focusing on during this period. They're really looking at production of illegal moonshine. And essentially they're kind of worrying about not necessarily people drinking alcohol, but the type of alcohol they're drinking. So by bringing in Komarov's relationship with alcohol, that feeds into one of the wider themes in this volume.
Yeah.
So that's a part of the case which I couldn't find elsewhere in the newspaper reports, but I think is kind of teased out a bit more because it fits into the new Soviet like kind of idea of what people should do and what they shouldn't do. So they also talk about a bit more of Komarov's biography. So just to cover everything, basically he's brought up in Belarus, right? He's in rural Belarus. That's where he is with his family, and this stuff happens with dad and his brother. Actually, he, Vasily, ends up going away to work as a servant around 14 years of age. So during this time, the criminologists describe him kind of entering the school of life, like how some of my friends described the university of life. Like they didn't go to uni, but they've been to the university of life, right? So Komarov, like during this time, he discusses later that he began drinking all kinds of different things, shoe polish, mechanical fluid. And also he loses his virginity at what we would now consider to be quite a young age as well. So he leaves home, he goes to work as a servant. Yeah, he kind of moves around a little bit. He tends to run away quite a lot. And because of this, he really finds it difficult to find consistent work. He does somewhat remarkably remain married to his first wife, whose name isn't mentioned in any account that I can find of this, for 28 years. Right, so he has a 28-year marriage despite the frequent alcohol-related scandals. Right, they use this word specifically, scandals that happen in the family home. So again, like it kind of fascinated me to try and find more about what they mean by scandals. He also, a big part of what the criminologists do with this case is they talk about his military experience. So obviously the Soviets come along and they want to immediately try to eradicate all remnants of what existed before the revolution. And one of the biggest things is Russia going into the First World War. So any military history is brought out in the account by the criminologists. So there's a war between Russia and Japan in 1905. Komarov it doesn't seem that he goes to fight in that war. He does travel quite close to the region, and he's involved in business ventures.
Yeah.
And again, there are no more details. I mean, I'm assuming it's something pretty shady, but yeah, this is kind of discussed. You know, he's there for the Russo-Japanese War, even though he's not fighting. He's still surrounded by warfare. He has this little period where he obviously makes quite a lot of money doing whatever he's been doing, and him and his first wife travel around a little bit until they kind of squander it all, and he gets imprisoned. So 40 years old, he's imprisoned for stealing apples from a warehouse that he works for. So I don't know, again, like the scale of this. I don't know if it's one apple or like 400 apples.
That's kind of having quite severe punishments, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean Russia is known for harsh punishments. So he goes into prison for a little while. During this time, his first wife passes away. She has cholera. So he comes out, but he gets married to Sophia, who way back at the start I mentioned she gets sentenced to the death penalty with him. She's a widow with two children. She's in Poland. So Vasily and Sophia, they are forced to travel around a little bit because of the First World War. But then Komarov joins the Red Army. Like, he joins the Red Army in 1917. I'm assuming that it's after the First Revolution in 1917, which is February. But he joins the Red Army, and he learns to read and write, and he rises to the rank of a platoon commander. So yeah. There's this guy who's had this quite an eventful life. Yeah, he got banged up for a little while. He didn't have a very nice upbringing. And he's now become a platoon commander. His recalls in a number of different accounts that I've looked at. So I'm going to continue to try and chase that up. But
yeah,
this period, this is where there are a number of events which the criminologists suggest really change Vasily. So he reportedly authorizes his own battalion to shoot a spy. So they find a spy among their ranks, and he authorizes their execution. He takes part in another vote to execute a White Army soldier. So the Civil War is the Red Army against the White Army. So he takes part in this vote to execute an enemy soldier, essentially. And also, he himself is captured, but has the foresight to change his own surname. So this is where, you know, right back at the beginning, you know, he's known as Komarov in every single account, but actually he was originally Petrov. So he changes his own surname to avoid execution. Pretty kind of smart piece of survival at that point. So this experience of warfare is obviously brought up by the criminologists, suggesting that there is something quite close to, you know, what we would understand as PTSD. So again, it's like something that is really difficult to quantify. Like, I don't doubt that so much happens to him in his life, but it's hard to pinpoint like one thing and say, yeah. Oh, it's, you know, it's relationship.
I think it's very rarely just one thing.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
it's an escalation.
Yeah, well, you can kind of see these things kind of fitting together, right?
Yeah,
that he has a kind of traumatic childhood. He drinks a lot. He really struggles to, apart from his marriage, which stays together for 28 years, which is pretty good going. He's a drifter, essentially. But this experience of warfare is really brought out in the criminological account because it's an experience that only happens because of the evils of the previous regime. So that kind of fits into the Soviet worldview as well. So Komarov at this point, he's been in prison for stealing apples. He's been a platoon commander. He then gets discharged in 1920. So we're kind of getting close to when these murders start. So he arrives in Moscow for the first time, and he becomes working as a cab driver for a refugee organization. So a cab driver like in Moscow during this time is not the same as an Uber driver now, right? He basically pulls people's stuff around the city using a sled, you know, like I was saying, on a rope. But he uses the opportunity to work for this refugee organization to begin to steal stuff and sell it on to make a little bit of money. Around February, he commits his first murder. So this all starts to kind of build up and build up. From the first victim, or the first couple of victims, I think, actually, he's able to buy a horse, and he works then as an independent cab driver. So rather than working for this refugee organization and pulling stuff around, he can go around on a horse. So it's suggested quite heavily that this is a vocation that is specially selected so he can dispose of the bodies, right? I mean, I think it's probably a little bit less calculated than that. I think that certainly it probably helps, but he's just been working as a cab driver anyway. So the logical step is to just become a different type of cab driver, but be able to, you know, have a horse and maybe make a bit more money and move around the city a bit more. So undoubtedly he does use this new kind of vocation to do what he does later with the bodies, but I don't quite see it in the same way as the criminologist, who suggest that he almost like flicks through a list of possible jobs and he comes up with one that he would be able to dump these bodies with. I think it's a bit more kind of organic, a bit more, I don't know, like that process seems to just fall into place a bit more.
Yeah,
it's just a logical step, right? You know, I've been working as a cab driver, but pulling stuff around and breaking my body doing it. I'm going to buy a horse and do what I've been doing, but I'm going to not be destroying my body anymore. I'm going to get the horse to do everything for me.
Yeah, because he's pretty old at this point as well.
So he's getting towards the half century, you know. So he also at this time has this really interesting little incident where he he's already committed, I think, two murders, and he gets apprehended and fined. He doesn't quite get arrested and banged up, but there's some kind of drunken episode again. I think they even refer to it as a scandal, which doesn't give me much to go on at all. But so he kind of comes face to face with the authorities, right? But they're completely unaware of his more murderous activities. You know, so he's killed two people at this point, but he's there and he's apprehended and he's fine. So he's in some kind of police custody, or, you know, a kind of that part of it is very similar to a lot of crime dramas, you know, where you see a detective and the murderer and they kind of cross paths a little bit. So I find that episode, there's absolutely no way of tracing that again whatsoever. But so the rest of the account really does go through in detail how the murders are carried out. Normally I have to, a disclaimer was put on something I wrote online for this bit, but I'm assuming that for the podcast audience, I can just go for it, right? People get a bit squeamish.
Oh, there's your disclaimer.
I wrote something for the website and it was up for 2 months and I didn't read it. But I don't really like reading my own stuff once it's, gone. Mm-hmm. And one of my friends sent me an email and said, your article was really cool, but they put a disclaimer in the middle of it.
you've warned us now.
So this MO that he has, right, which I kind of referred to briefly earlier, so this is elaborated on in wider accounts, right? It doesn't make it into the New York Times police reports. But basically, he looks to bring these peasants who've gone to Moscow, for work, back to his apartment on the pretext of selling them a horse or some other kind of horse-related product. I don't really know that much about horses to tell you what that could have been. But he gets them back to his apartment. And then he offers them a drink, right? He sits them on a chair in the middle of the room. He says, do you want some wine or do you want some vodka? And then he goes and he gets some kind of document, almost like a kind of receipt, or a bill of sale or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he gives them that to read while they're sat on a chair in the middle of the room. So this part always makes me think of Lethal Weapon. They walk into a room and it's covered in clear plastic, right? Because they're going to bag up the bodies. So someone walks, into his apartment completely unaware, and there's a chair in the middle of the room. They get sat down on it. He gives them this document, this receipt, and then as they're reading it, he goes and gets a hammer off the side, and he walks up behind them. He kind of reaches his arm round, and he hits them as hard as he can. So this knocks the victims unconscious, fairly obviously. He does then apparently try and tidy up a little bit, let the blood trip out into a bowl that he has, and then he strangles them to kind of finish them off. So again, if you read a lot about serial killers, it's probably not that gruesome. But at this point, he then tells his wife and his children to leave the house or get out of the apartment. And the first time I read that, I thought I'd read it the wrong way around. I thought that he would have told them that earlier.
Yeah,
but I reread it, and actually, I don't think I am wrong. And yeah, definitely, the account seems to suggest that they're there in the apartment at the same time. Whether or not that's something to put whoever it is who goes back at ease a little bit, because there are children there and because his wife's there. But basically, once he kills his victims, he kicks his wife and kids out, and he stashes the body away in a wardrobe. This is where he starts to then come up with this plan about where to take the corpses. And most of them are taken reasonably kind of nearby. I mean, I use a map on Google when I'm doing lectures on this. They're in a really tight vicinity around where he lives. There's a derelict mansion that's close by. So six bodies are taken to this derelict mansion. There's also, he's in 22 Shabalovka Street. There is no one at this point in 24 right next to his. So he takes a whole load of them there as well. And then I think he probably runs out of viable options in those two places. So he starts taking them down to there's a side street that's pretty close. And then he starts to take them a little bit further and just leaves them on the bank of the river, kind of in these bags. He just puts them down by the bank of the river. And then he then goes off on his horse again. So the fact that he has the same MO is interesting. But I mean, I think, again, this guy just seems to be, a lot of this is done for very, in his head, right, you know, obviously there is a lot going on there, and you know, it's not my place to try and figure that out, but a lot of this seems to be done for like practical reasons. I think the MO is the same because he keeps getting away with it, right? And there's no, it's so hard to tell, you know, from anything I've read, whether he derived any kind of pleasure whatsoever from it. Doesn't seem to. He seems to find his trial proceedings quite amusing, which there might be something there, but I'm uncomfortable with this idea of people going back in time and trying to psychoanalyze people, because it's such a difficult thing to do, you know, kind of in the moment. For us in 2018 anyway, that to go back to Moscow in, yeah, the early 1920s and try and figure it out along with all the stuff that he's grown up with. I wouldn't be confident enough to say for certain. It's definitely the PTSD stuff. It's definitely just him doing it because he needs money. It's so many things that come together. So I think the final point that I'm going to make is one that I kind of quite often do when I've done the lectures on it, is that I barely mentioned his wife at all, other than her getting kicked out of the apartment. But she gets the same punishment as he does, right? And there's the photo of them I referred to at the start. She's sitting there, and you know, she looks like a, you know, kind of old babushka, like, you know, like when I go to Moscow, I see loads of similar looking sweet old ladies on the metro. But she's barely like mentioned at all. I think that the fact that they bring back the death penalty, just for these two, at least it appears that way, is a really interesting point. But also that she isn't ever discussed, like, at any length whatsoever, like that she, you know, that she is sentenced for being his accomplice. And I think that is because the criminological bureau that I've referred to, they are trying to suggest that. So the revolution was a very emancipating time for women, and that feeds into criminological thought during this time. And they are starting to show that women are taking part in crime, like moving into male-dominated areas, you know, increasingly often. Yeah. But this account of Sophia places her in a very kind of patriarchal, traditional relationship. Like, she just goes along with what her husband does, so she doesn't fit into anything else in this criminological, you know, volume that I found, which is talking about how women are becoming bandits more often, how women are murdering people more often. She is kind of, you know, almost like put completely out of view, because she doesn't fit into their kind of narrative of the fact that women are taking part in, you know, in crime and, you know, previously a kind of like more male dominated, you know, area in greater numbers. So she fascinates me, I think, just as much as Vasily.
I'd definitely be more interested in finding out about her if anything comes up.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't know what I'm gonna be doing with it. I think I like this idea of continuing to look at, like, I look a lot inside labor camps and inside prisons. I like in my head, like, the next projects I'm going to do are on criminal spaces outside of penality areas, like there are areas that are similar to what this part of the city is like, which are kind of referred to as slums, basically. And there's a lot of, you know, obviously a lot of like horrible stuff goes on there. So I'm starting to look at, you know, like Shabalovka Street, where Vasily is, as being an area where there are opportunities to do, you know, criminalized acts. I think I'm going to, one of the things I'm going to start looking at is criminal spaces, like during this period, because there's so much going on. You know, we've like talked about the, you know, the famine and the civil war, and the fact that, you know, this case draws such a large audience, they decide to just bring back the death penalty for it. So I think there's way more to be told for this story. There's also, actually, and this is going to be my final point about the criminologists revised down the total of murders as well. And there is no other reason for them to do this other than that they want to take away the more sensationalized aspects of the case. So their biggest thing during this time is not bringing into view like touch of celebrity criminals.
Yeah.
So before the revolution, there are quite a few, you know, well-known bandits. There's a very, very famous thief called Sonka Golden Hand. She's like almost like the kind of
that's a good name.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. She's got a bunch of TV shows about her and some awful rap songs as well. But what they do after the revolution is they start looking at the wider mass of crime, you know, looking at celebrities less and less. So I think that's why everything is played down. I think that's why there's no Wolf of Shabalovka Street. I think that's I actually also think that that's why they use the double-barreled name in this case, because that even yeah. that takes away a little bit of, you know, of the kind of individualism of it. So there is way, way more, I think, to be discovered about this case. But for now, that's pretty much all I've got.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you. That was great. That was a really interesting case, actually.
I felt a bit disjointed.
It's fine. That's what editing does.
Yeah. I trust you to do a good job on that.
I'll try my best. It's fine. I think that's pretty good, actually. It's not one I've heard of before, so I'm pretty happy.
Basically, the only serial killers people only really only find out about. I'm like a big fan of these TV shows where they, you know, it's almost like a countdown of serial killers, and these, you know, you get to service stations, there's like kind of, you know, 100 serial killers books.
I've got
a bunch of those. And the only Russian serial killers in there are, you know, kind of from the second half of the 20th century, you know, mainly from the 80s and 90s. So this was an opportunity to, basically people know about this case. There's on Russian Wikipedia that, you know, Komarov has a pretty lengthy description on there, but nothing exists in English. So I'm trying to kind of be the person who does that, I guess.
Yeah.
I just did something a little bit different. This was like, for me, a side project, you know.
Oh, I liked it. Yeah. So if that's everything, we'll cut to music and then come back with part two. Sound good?
Awesome.
Cool. So see you guys in a bit. And we are back. So, that was Vasily Komarov. Now, let's talk about the Korean axe murder incident, also known as the Hatch incident or the Poplar Tree incident, or the tree trimming incident, which doesn't really bring to mind the idea of the US nearly going to war, does it? So, but just to start off, how many people do you think it would take to cut down just a single poplar tree? Just normally.
I'm going to guess, I don't know, like a dozen people?
Well, I'll say that. Like, this was a little different. So, I think the best way to start this is just kind of give a little bit of background. So, this occurred, like, on the North-South Korea border in 1976. And technically, it's, like, two events that kind of joined together in one. And the first one occurred on August 18th, 1976. But before that, let's talk about the general area, because I think a lot of people know what the demilitarized zone is, but just to clear things up a little bit, essentially a barrier divides the Korean peninsula about in half, and it was created as an agreement between North Korea, the UN, and China in 1953. It's about 160 miles long, 250 kilometers for you Americans, and about 2.5 miles or 4 kilometers wide. And it's essentially a big area where they're not allowed to have proper like military installations and stuff. Then to narrow it down a bit closer to our area, we need to go to the joint security area, which is the only portion of this zone where the North and South Korean forces essentially stand face to face. And it was used by the Koreas for things like diplomatic engagements, prisoner exchanges, etc. And there were military negotiations between the North Korean and United Nations command. And it's also near something called the Bridge of No Return, which is a bridge that was used for prisoner exchanges towards the end of the Korean War in 1953. The name comes from basically when they were releasing prisoners of war, they wanted a bridge, and they could either choose to stay in the country where they were captured or cross the bridge to return to their homeland. But if they crossed, they'd never be allowed to return, even if they changed their minds. And in this joint security area, and pretty close to the bridge, there was about 30-meter tall poplar tree, and it blocked the line of sight between the United Nations Command checkpoint number 3 and observation post number 5, just arbitrary numbered posts. And command post number 3 was situated essentially next to the Bridge of No Return and was northmost point of the United Nations Command. Yeah, and it was only visible from the observation post during the winter months, as during the summer months, you could only see the top of it, which, needless to say, is a bit of a security no-no. And it was also only visible from one other checkpoint. So essentially, on August the 18th, 1976, they sent a group of 5 Korean Service Corps personnel along with a United Nations Command Security Team, which was made up of Captain Arthur Boniface, the South Korean Captain Kim, who was the platoon leader of the platoon in the area, and about 11 enlisted personnel, which made up both American and South Korean troops. And they went into the joint security area to trim the tree. The two captains didn't have any sidearms or anything because members of the joint security area were only allowed to have 5 armed officers and 30 armed enlisted personnel at a time. But they had like mattocks in the back of their truck and the workers had axes to cut the tree branches. So they go about a job as normal, start trimming this tree. And shortly after, about 15 North Korean soldiers appeared under the command of a senior lieutenant, Pak Chul, who had a history of confrontations with the UN soldiers. And they kind of just watch casually for about 15 minutes, and then he goes up and says, "Stop trimming this tree," under the reason that it couldn't be trimmed because, to quote, "Kim Il-sung personally planted it and nourished it, and it's growing under his supervision." And to this, Captain Boniface kind of just ordered them to continue and turned his back on Lieutenant Pak Chul. Wasn't a great idea. As after being ignored by Boniface, Pak essentially sent a guy back across the bridge of no return. And a few minutes later, a North Korean guard truck comes across the bridge with about 20 more North Korean guards carrying crowbars and clubs. And he again says, "Stop trimming this tree." Boniface, once again, he just turns his back on him, which Lieutenant Pak kind of just, according to this page, he removed his watch, carefully wrapped it in a handkerchief, placed it in his pocket, and shouted, "Kill the bastards." So the North Korean guys attacked, including using axes that were dropped by the tree trimmers, and knocked Captain Boniface to the ground, bludgeoning him to death by approximately 5 North Korean troops. He also had Lieutenant Barrett, who would jump over a low wall, leading to about 4.5 meter deep depression that's filled with trees and stuff across the road. And worth noting that this depression wasn't visible from the road at all because of all the grass and trees. And the entire fight lasts about 20 to 30 seconds and was actually caught on video. And the United Nations Command Force dispersed North Korean guards just long enough to place Captain Boniface's body in the truck and kind of get out there. But there was no sign of Lieutenant Barrett still. And the guards at the observation post couldn't see him either. It's got funny going on here. Yeah, as the UNC force, they did see North Korean guards at the Korean outpost, kind of weird behaviors going on. Yeah, what's going on is that one guard would take an axe and go into this depression for a few minutes, then come back up, give the axe to another guard, and that guard would repeat the process for about 90 minutes. And around now, the guards at the observation post were informed that Barrett was missing, so they tell their superiors and stuff about the activity in the depression, and a search and rescue squad gets dispatched. And they find Barrett attacked by an axe by the North Koreans. They got Barrett out of there, but he died en route to the hospital. So tensions is getting pretty high, yeah? And like I said, it was caught on camera from a guard at observation post number 5 who recorded it with a 35mm camera with a telephoto lens along with a black and white camera which ran out of film during it. It was also recorded by a guard at command post number 3 at the bridge no return with a movie camera. And you can actually still find this footage of the fight. I find that it's not very often you see, like, actual footage of events like this. But, yeah, anyway. Shortly after this happened, the North Korean media starts airing the reports of the fight. And they state it, and to quote, "Around 10:45 a.m. today, the American imperialist aggressors sent in 14 hoodlums with axes into a joint security area to cut the tree on their own accord. Although such a work should have been mutually consented beforehand, 4 persons from our side went to the spot to warn them not to continue the work without our consent. Against our persuasion, they attacked our guards en masse and committed a serious provocative act of beating our men, wielding murderous weapons, and depending on the fact that they outnumbered us. Our guards could not but resort to self-defense measures under the circumstances of this reckless provocation." Yeah, it's very North Korean in wording, right?
Very.
And within 4 hours of the attack, Kim Jong-il, who wasn't the leader at the time, the leader was Kim Il-sung, whose father, addressed the Conference of Non-Aligned Nations in Colombo, Sri Lanka, and presented a paired document describing the incident as an unprovoked attack on North Korean guards led by American officers. and then proposing a resolution asking the conference to condemn the US provocation and essentially called on anyone at the council to endorse both the withdrawal of US forces from Korea and the dissolution of the United Nations command, which was seconded by Cuba, and the members of the conference passed a resolution. Meanwhile, the CIA considered the attack to be a pre-planned operation by the North Korean government, and they kind of thought up a range of responses. And and you can only consider what they would have spoken about before deciding.
I'm sure they were pretty reserved with their ideas.
Yeah, and considering this would have been a time of nuclear fear as well.
A few generals in that room who had their like kind of itchy fingers to press the button, man.
But like the readiness levels for American forces in South Korea were increased to DEFCON 3 on August 19. For a kind of comparison, DEFCON 3 was what the state was raised to after 9/11. Essentially, DEFCON levels, you have a 5 through 1, with 1 being the highest readiness. And I believe you have 2 above that, which are emergency and something else. I think it's emergency and air emergency, but that's off the top of my head, and I'm not entirely sure. Said stuff like rockets, but this was discounted as the ratio of artillery between like the North and the US and South Korea. It was 4-1, so not so great. And on top of this, President Park Chung-hee didn't want any military action taken. Like, of course, from at least one first-hand interview that I read about, essentially the US forces that were stationed there wanted blood. Which is reasonable considering what has happened. But in the end, they decided on something a little different, you know, just a little different. And they decided to try and cut down a tree again, but it was a little different this time, just a little different. And they commenced Operation Paul Bunyan on August 21 at 7 o'clock in the morning, about 3 days after this happened. And just a side note, Paul Bunyan is named after a legendary lumberjack from American folklore. Ooh. Which might be one of the most American things I've ever heard of.
they have Paul Bunyan like on loads of like craft beer and stuff in the States. Very, 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 you know, old school American.
Yeah. So let's get into it, shall we? So they sent Task Force Viera over, which is a convoy of 23 American and South Korean vehicles named after Lieutenant Colonel Victor S. Viera, who was the commander of the United States Army Support Group. And they drove into the JSA without any warnings to the North Koreans, who at the time only had one observation post manned at the time, because it was pretty early in the morning, you know. And in the vehicles, they had 2 8-man teams of military engineers from the 2nd Engineer Battalion, who were equipped with chainsaws to cut down the tree. These teams were accompanied by 2 30-man security platoons from the Joint Security Force, who were armed with pistols and axe handles, with the 1st platoon securing the north entrance to the JSA via the bridge of no return, and the 2nd platoon securing the southern edge of the area. So quite a lot of people already, yeah? And at the same time, there's a team from B Company commanded by a Captain Walter Seafried, who had activated the detonation systems for charges on the Freedom Bridge with a 165mm main gun of a M728 combat engineer vehicle aimed around the middle of it, so if the order was given to destroy it, the bridge would definitely fall. And B Company, who was supporting the E Company, who were on the bridge, built some M4T6 rafts on the Imjin River in case there was a situation requiring emergency evacuation. In addition, it keeps going. they sent a 64-man task force of the South Korean Special Forces, who were armed with clubs and trained in Taekwondo, supposedly without firearms, but but once they parked their trucks near the bridge of no return, they went to the bottom of the trucks and started throwing out the sandbags that lined them. And hidden behind the sandbags were a bunch of M16 rifles and M79 grenade launchers hidden below. Several of the commandos also had M18 claymore mines strapped to their chests with the firing mechanism in their hands, and started shouting at North Koreans to cross the bridge. In addition, a US infantry company with 20 utility helicopters and 7 Cobra attack helicopters circled behind them. And behind these helicopters, all the way from Guam, they sent B-52 Stratofortresses escorted by US F-4 Phantom II jets from the Kunsan Air Base, and South Korean F-5 and F-86 fighters were visible flying across the sky at high altitude. They also sent out bombers of the 366th Tactical Fighter Wing out from the Mountain Home Air Force Base, along with F-4 Phantoms from the 18th Inner Air Base and Clark Air Base deployed. They also moved the aircraft carrier USS Midway Task Force to a station just offshore. And near the edges of DMZ, they sent a bunch of heavily armed US and South Korean infantry and artillery, including the 2nd Battalion 71st Air Defense Regiment, armed with improved Hawk missiles. They also had armor waiting to back them up as well. Bases near the DMZ were ready for demolition in case of a military response. In addition, 12,000 additional troops were ordered to Korea, including 1,800 Marines from Okinawa. And during the operation, nuclear-capable strategic bombers circled over the JSA. And yeah, it was a lot of dudes. Just Task Force Vieira, which was the group that actually went into JSA to cut down the trees, just Task Force Vieira was 813 men. Pretty much all of them were from the United States Army Support Group, including the Joint Security Force, a South Korean reconnaissance company, and a South Korean Special Forces company, which had infiltrated the river area by the bridge the night before. They also had members of a reinforced composite rifle company from the 9th Infantry Regiment. And in addition to this, they had every United Nations command force in the rest of South Korea on battle alert. Remember, they're just cutting down a tree.
It's not over the top at all. This is
entirely a show of force.
Like imagine if you're like towards the back end of that like onslaught, like you're those 12,000 troops, and they, you know, it's like, well, you know, why are we being sent there? It's like, oh, there's this tree, right?
at the time it's like two soldiers are just being like stripped, just killed in broad daylight in front of and recorded, and have been told that they were the aggressors.
Yeah,
like a lot of the US were pretty reasonably pissed. But yeah, anyway, let's go to the actual operation now that we've just gone through all the forces engaged here. So the engineers in the convoy were led by 1st Lieutenant Patrick Ono, who had conducted a recon of the tree about 2 days before. They left their vehicles once the convoy arrived and started immediately cutting down the tree while standing on the roof of their truck, while another truck was positioned to block the bridge on the return. The rest of the task force went to their assigned areas around the tree and started guarding the engineers. North Korea, they responded with about 150 to 200 troops with machine guns and assault rifles arriving in buses, just kind of watching them at first. And as soon as they arrived, Lieutenant Colonel Vieira sent out a radio communication where the helicopters and Air Force jets started becoming visible over the horizon. Which, can you imagine what that must look like if you're just there with a small group of people?
It's like something off the A-Team.
And at the Kota Air Base in Japan, the flight line runway was nose to tail with a dozen C-130s ready to provide backup. Like the North Koreans, to their credit, they got out of the bus and started setting up their 2-man machine gun positions. Just kind of watched in silence as the tree was felled. It took 42 minutes, which is sort of super stressful while being watched by both of these forces, right? imagine being the people that are just cutting down the tree. And 5 minutes into the operation, the United Nations command notified North Koreans that a UN work party had entered the JSA in order to peacefully finish the work left unfinished. The South Korean troops also vandalized 2 North Korean guard posts and removed 2 road barriers installed by North Koreans. And at the end, they left about 6 meters or 20 foot tall tree stump standing deliberately. And then they kind of just left, along with all their troops. It's a ridiculous amount of force that they used.
That's insane.
And remember, this was during peacetime as well.
Yeah, I don't know the US like during this time understood really what peacetime was.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth noting that one of the troops involved in the operation was Moon Jae-in, who was elected the president of South Korea in 2017. And
really?
Yeah, and it's president today.
No way.
Yeah, let's just knock out the aftermath anyway, real quick. So yeah, the operation went down, to quote, peacefully.
I'm sure.
But obviously there was a lot of concern that like, there were a lot of increased tensions along across the zone, and people were worried it might cause a war, but this never actually came to fruition. Though some shots were fired at the US helicopter carrying Major General Morris Brody, but no one was injured though. And the United Nations Command demanded that the North Koreans punish those involved and make adequate reparations to the families of those killed and injured like, later on that day. And they received a message from Kim Il-sung like shortly after, expressing regret at the incident. And the message was sent a senior member of the North Korean forces, Major General Han Ju-kyung, to the senior United Nations forces, the United Nations Command, Rear Admiral Mark Fridden, reading to quote, this is also another very, very North Korean propagandist message, as you'll notice. So, it was a good thing that no big incident occurred at Panmunjom for a long period. However, it is regretful that an incident occurred in the joint security area, Panmunjom, at this time. An effort must be made so that such incidents may not recur in the future. For this purpose, both sides should make efforts. We urge your side to prevent the provocation. Our side will never provoke first, but take self-defense measures only when provocation occurs. This is our consistent stand. So it's like, yeah. I'd call the message itself almost provocative. It's not what they asked for, but the US administration essentially decided that they'll accept it because it was the first time since the Korean War armistice that the North had accepted responsibility for any violence along the DMZ. And in the end, essentially, it caused the North Koreans to lose face. And like one of the US soldiers that did it, called Bill Ferguson, said that you have to be strong. If there's any sign of weakness, the North Koreans won't respect you. And this is actually the guy that said he wanted blood as well. Because it's like the military. But the military operation was not what the troops at a joint security area wanted, he told me. He wanted blood, was the exact quote from the article. And yeah, so the JSA's advanced camp, later renamed Camp Boniface in order of the slain company commander, changed from Camp Kitty Hawk, which is a great name, and a barrack readiness facility, which is located inside the JSA, housing the battalion's North Mission Platoon, was named for Lieutenant Barrett. The site of the tree, the stump was cut down in 1987 and became the location of a stone monument with a brass plate inscribed in the memory of both men. Commemorative ceremonies are done at the monument on anniversaries. The nearby checkpoint near the Bridge of No Return was no longer used after the mid-1980s, after they built concrete-filled bollards in the road to make it impossible for vehicles to pass. And yeah, it also prompted like separation of personnel from both sides to avoid further incidents. And that's pretty much everything I've got. Like, apparently, there's an axe and axe handle which were used in the incident on display in the North Korea Peace Museum. And part of the wood that was collected from the poplar tree was used by General William J. Livesey as a swagger stick between 1984 and 1987, until he retired and it passed on to to General Lewis C. Military. Yeah, I think that's everything I've got.
That's kind of terrifying event, you know. I don't think I'm going to be able to sleep tonight thinking about like that much military force. It's just a show of force, right? Send everything we've got and they would do whatever they can to avoid coming into like conflict with us. But Just like to have that on hand and just be like, right, we're going to send it over there.
No, they put all this together in 3 days.
Yeah. I know, you know, they're a bit based in the, in, you know, in that region anyway, but still, like, you know, it's a ridiculous amount of stuff coming together. And then, for the Koreans who were there as well, like, seeing this all happening, it's like, what, we got to maybe fight against that.
And like I said earlier, when they arrived, there was one man post.
Yeah. And also, I mean, with everything else, why'd they bother sending in people who are, I mean, I like Taekwondo, man. I like, yeah, martial arts anyway, but I mean, they're not really needed.
Yeah, like proper South Korean special forces.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. No, that was awesome.
Yeah, it's like, I can't remember if I said it in the episode or if I said it to someone else before the episode, but if there's one thing the US is good at, it's a show of force.
Yeah, of course.
And the South Korean as well, because it was a joint operation. I don't want to take that away from
that. but they do, I mean, just like everything about that. I mean, the Bridge of Sighs, and No Return, right? Anyway, reminded me of the Bridge of Sighs. You know, like in Venice, there's this really famous bridge where prisoners are taken, and they've replicated that. There's one in Cambridge actually as well, a much smaller version. Bridge of No Return just sounds like it's from Lord of the Rings, right?
It really does. It really, really does.
So I love the start of, you know, when you were talking about it, like the symbolism there. You know, this thing, like the, you know, this tree and this bridge. I kind of get why they would be so upset about it. Also, the response from the US is just like an action film, right?
From reading about, I didn't actually see if it was confirmed that Kim Il-sung had anything to do with the tree, like, growing.
Nah.
There wasn't any confirmation of it I saw. But, Yeah.
But I just like that it is about a tree.
Yeah. I mean, it was probably one of the most important trees that we've had in the last few years.
Yeah, the contrast with that, like, with that thing, like, having grown out of the ground for so long, and then all this new, like, military technology.
About 40 years ago now, nearly.
Yeah.
So in the mid-70s, so it wasn't even that long ago, really.
No, that was, you know, it's still the same, like, US, like, foreign policy is still influenced by the same kind of attitudes and same opinions.
It's worth noting on a side note, I was reading about the Korean War a little bit as well, and it's like it has been called one of the forgotten wars.
Yeah, I think just because of it just gets so eclipsed by Vietnam.
Yeah, I know. It's I was reading about it. It's about 3 million people died during it, which is
there's a lot of other shady stuff that US got up to around that time, and you know, Latin America.
Yeah, of course.
But it's like Vietnam gets the attention because it has cool films about it, right?
I think I think Vietnam was more famous just because of how it had a lot of striking imagery going on during but there was a lot of propaganda. Yeah. There was a lot of the booby traps were very striking. I'd highly recommend looking up videos of the booby traps, because there's like demonstration of like in museums and stuff on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
Ridiculous. But anyway, we should before we keep going on, we should cut to music and come up with an outro. I think sound good.
Cool. Yeah.
Be right back, guys. And we are back. So, any last comments before we close up?
No, other than I'm going to try and check out those videos now. I totally want to find out more. Like, more about Korea as well, actually. Which you're right. Like, I kind of overlooked it as well, because I like stuff about Vietnam a little more, and because of the kind of what it represents. There's a more kind of raw emotion attached to Vietnam. I'm going to spend the next few days, I think, just checking out as much stuff about Korean War as I can.
Yeah, there's a bunch of different wars like in the last in the last century that I just completely forgotten about, because they're kind of overshadowed by the bigger ones, like, especially like the World Wars, Vietnam.
Yeah, I mean, like, what happens in Yugoslavia gets overlooked quite a lot. And also, like, probably Rwanda as well, like, kind of, you know, they both happen around about the same time, but...
Like, Africa in general is quite often just overlooked. Like, East African Front during World War One is nicknamed the Forgotten Front in a lot of things. And,
The further they happen away, you know, that's, people are still so attached to, you know, to the Blitz and, or, you know, and like, right, you know, kind of rightly so as well, and like the images from the First World War. So people, at least, you know, here in the UK, they don't tend to know that much. Unless through, like, unless America is involved, because, you know, there are cousins, right?
Yeah, it's like, in November, I'm planning on getting out a few World War One episodes, as November the 11th is the 100th anniversary of Armistice Day.
Oh, cool, yeah. No, I hadn't realised, because, I mean, that kind of period of, like, you know, centennial celebrations or remembrance, whatever, it's obviously gone on for such a long time. Like, there was, like, you know, when people were remembering, you know, 1914, and then the big battles that happened, like, the following year as well. And it's kind of, like, disappeared a little bit and almost kind of forgotten, right? We're coming up to the, you know, 100-year anniversary.
Yeah.
So, no, yeah, I mean, I'm sure those episodes will be awesome.
Well, I've got a few particular topics that I'm probably going to bring up. So, but I'm going to leave, I'm not going to bring too much out apart from that. But yeah, anyway. So, did you want to plug anything or?
Probably a few things, I guess. Like, so if anyone wants to read more on Vasily Komarov, I've got a blog post up on the Pushkin House blog. So, I guess if you just go to Pushkin's House website, you'll be able to get to it, or just Google Pushkin House blog.
If you tweet me the link, I'll retweet it on the page.
Yeah, that would be awesome. So yeah, there's a bit more stuff on there, and it's possibly a little more eloquent than me talking about it. I've got a book coming out next year, so buy my book next year. It's called Criminal Subculture in the Gulag, and it's coming out with IB Taurus probably in the summer, I guess. Like, we're looking at like maybe May or June at the moment. But in the meantime, if anyone wants to read about like Russian criminality, then check out Mark Bullen's book on tattoos. You know, Mark was on the podcast a while back. And there's another guy called Mark Galliotti, and he writes about the Wari, so the Russian mafia that the other Mark also talked about.
That's a lot of marks.
The only people who do anything about crime in Russia are called Mark. It turns out. So yeah, check out their books until mine ends up coming out. Oh, and come and watch me wrestle. Like, if anyone is anywhere near Norwich and wants to come and watch wrestling, then check out WAW. We did a big show at the weekend. We made national news because Norwich City Football had turned up at the end of it and won the main match. So yeah, they're the things I've got to plug.
Excellent. Cool. So, just to follow up on that, just Mark Bullen, if you listen to this, thanks for putting us in touch.
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
And on that, just a few plugs for myself. I'm going to plug the Murderly Network, which is murder.ly. If you go to that site, you can find a bunch of other really cool true crime podcasts. I'm going to give another shout out to Moxie from last week's episode, from Your Brain on Facts podcast, because I was a little late on giving that out, and I told her I'd plug it again this week, just as a thank you. But yeah, that was a really fun episode as well. What else? I think that's all I can think of right now. If I've got anything, I'll just add it in the next episode, because it's getting a bit late now, isn't it? We have social media. We've got Facebook at facebook.com/bloodontherocks. We have Twitter and Instagram at The Bloody Rocks. You can email me, talk about anything you really feel like, at botrpodcast@gmail.com. Let me think. I have a Discord group chat. You can find it in the description, because it's just a string of letters in the link. So, and we also have Patreon if you want to support the show, at patreon.com/bloodontherocks. And yeah, I think that's pretty much everything. So I think on that, we can Yeah, did you want to plug your social media at all?
Yeah, so just at Vincent Criminal. And you can get hold of me on a Gmail, which is Cult of the Urca. The Gmail is in the bio for the Twitter account anyway, so it's at Vincent Criminal on Twitter, and then you can find like various ways of contacting me on there. I don't care, like send me a DM. I don't mind how people get hold of me.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So on that, so thank you for joining me, and to all my listeners, thank you for listening. Rate, review, subscribe. Don't forget to tell your friends, and have a great week. I'll see you soon.